Welcome to Strategy Talk, where the contributors to strategypage.com discuss news as history and give you a unique view of events around the world. I'm Dan Masterson, publisher of strategypage.com, your host. We'll be talking to Jim Dunnigan, well-known military analyst, author, and editor of strategypage.com, and Austin Bay, author, columnist, and blogger. His blog can be found at austinbay.net. Jim and Austin, welcome this morning. I thought it would be good for us to visit Russia today and sort of talk about its borders and what's happening there. And, you know, they have a lot of exciting stuff going on there. But I thought we'd just take a trip around the map around Russia's border and talk about each of its bordering states and what the current condition is and what are the impacts on international relations and like that. But now, are there any current issues between Russia and Finland at this point?
No, but I think I should kick off, you know, with a general observation that applies to all these relationships with what the Russians call the near abroad. Russia and the United States have arranged to have a sit down to discuss the anti-missile system that the United States is installing in Eastern Europe.
Right.
The Russians are bringing with them the contract suspended for the last two years to supply Iran with S-300 missiles. That's sort of like a super patriot that bothers the Israelis a great deal. And apparently, I didn't put anything on this in Strategy Page because it is fairly speculative and we don't want to deal with speculation, but, you know, podcasts are different, anything goes. The big thing with the Russians is, and we have mentioned this, is that their military has fallen apart. I mean, it's basically, well, we've covered it enough in Strategy Page. I mean, it's really pathetic. Their only defense for the country is their nuclear weapons, which they have continued to invest money in. I mean, they've reduced the number of warheads, you know, by 70% since the Cold War, but they still got, you know, several thousand, you know, warheads in sea-based and land-based, you know, ballistic missiles. That's their only defense.
Right.
And that's the reason why they are so upset about this anti-Iran missile system being put in Eastern Europe, which the Eastern Europeans, by and large, are fairly enthusiastic about. The Western Europeans, who the missiles are being put there to defend them, are less enthusiastic. But anyway, it looks like the Russians are hoping that Obama will say, "Okay, you know, we'll shut that down, and you won't send missiles to Iran." And everybody will be happy. But what the Russians are mostly concerned about is anything that has a negative impact on their last defensive weapon, and that's their nukes. Without their nukes, they're defenseless, especially against the Chinese.
Dan, I want to make a point, too, okay, about their problems in Moscow. And we're going to go around the borders, but I characterized the current regime as in a recent On Point, one of my columns, is a oligarchy of crooks, and it really is.
No,
I mean,
doubt.
You follow what happens out of the end of Yeltsin's presidency, and we've got to be honest about it. Things begin to get very dishonest in the rush towards what they were calling you know, capitalism, the KGB, and individuals with great government influence suddenly becoming corporate chieftains, and that's passed on to Putin. And I call these guys crooks that are well-schooled, though, in the use of ethnic and religious rivalries, in part because I was talking about Kosovo in that particular column, but also in border disputes and how border disputes can be used to reinforce their own power there in Moscow. It's a rallying cause, and it's one that appeals instantly to the Russian sense of national grievance, of always being threatened and the Russian on their borders. And of course the Russian response is that if we feel threatened, we're liable to attack you. Now, I'm just trying to, the connection I'm making here is that that crooked regime has an interest in maintaining its own security, and part of that is rallying to causes on threats, especially to Russian ethnic groups on the periphery or in the near abroad, the Russian ethnic communities that are still extant in former Soviet republics. And with that, I guess we'll start our geography quiz.
Right. Well, to add to that, one of the interesting things about Russia proper now, the new state, is that 72% are Russian. So they've got quite a homogeneous society, but it's along the borders where they end up with all these ethnic groups. The other thing that's interesting is Russia is experiencing the same thing that Europe is experiencing, which is a decline in their population, but the Russians don't have something that's replacing it. In Europe, the Muslims are, you know, coming in as workers and like that, but they don't have that in Russia. And the
Well, they do to a certain extent. They have Chinese sneaking in
right.
the Far East, which they don't want, and they have Muslims sneaking in from the, you know, the stans, you know, some of the previous parts of the Soviet Empire, which they don't want. So they have illegal immigration, which they don't want.
Right.
For obvious reasons, because
yeah.
the one portion of the population which is, you know, increasing is the non-Russian, the non-Slav.
Right.
Mostly Muslim.
Yeah.
So they're very concerned about that, as well they should be.
Yeah. Now, the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, those are of no real concern to Russia, correct?
Well, yes and no. Let's go back to Finland where we
okay.
started.
All right.
Finland is an interesting case because the Finns have learned how to live with the bear. As we know, Finland used to be part of Russia. It broke away after World War I and stayed broken away, much to the disgust of the communists, the Reds, who won the Civil War, because Finland was always one of the more reliable and productive portions of the Russian Empire. But the Finns are very clever, and they managed to cut deals. Now, when World War II came along, Stalin wanted more, as he always did. And he wanted a big portion of Finland because he felt he needed protection. They fought a war with the Finns. The Finns fought valiantly, but they lost. They gave up the ground. And after World War II, they managed to talk their way out of further punishment because the Finns allied themselves with the Germans during World War II. Well, I mean, who are you going to use for a war and lost to Russia? So whose side are you going to be on? After World War to the Finns basically made a deal with the Soviet Union that they would be their portal, Russia's portal to the West. They would provide all sorts of services, some of which are still secret. But basically they made themselves useful. And they still do that. They basically perfected the art of national obsequiousness.
Right.
You know, my lord, whatever I can do, my lord, you know, let me tug my forelock a few more times. No other neighbor of Russia has ever managed to pull that off. So it's good that you mentioned the Finns. Even though nothing ever happens on the Finnish front, so to speak, they are remarkable in that they have learned how to live with the bear, which isn't easy, as every other neighbor of Russia can tell you.
Right.
Well, this is also where you get the term Finlandization. And
yet, yeah.
Without spending a great deal of time on it, Finland has one of the best military reputations, and the way they use their reserve forces in the Winter War against Stalin, and the Russians knew that the Finns were prepared to fight a very aggressive Stalin's the guerrilla war, but it was a Finnish type guerrilla war if they really were invaded. So the trade-off that Jim has described, there was also a spine of steel behind the Finns. Despite the the wimp rhetoric, they had a bayonet, and they had shown that to the Russians, and the Russians simply said, okay, you give us what we want, we're going to recognize that. I wanted to make a point as we move into the Baltics, though.
Okay.
I generally agree with your characterization, Dan, except the thing is that the Russians And Putin plays this card all the time, this Cold War nostalgia, when Russia, what Russia said really mattered to the rest of Europe. And they look there and see the connections between Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia and the West, and they're turning their backs on Russia. So their view on this is that, okay, you guys, we're here, we're still powerful, and there's a political dimension to it, not so much a military dimension. Now, they really don't see them as a threat at all, but they say that nostalgia for when we had the power and we had you under our thumb, we're going to show you what we can do every so often. They certainly did that with Estonia in that little bizarre cyber war, which we have discussed in previous podcasts.
Yeah, Americans tend to forget that. History means a lot more in Europe, especially in Russia. The Baltics have figured in Russian history for centuries, and not so favorably. The Balts were basically those smart asses on the coast who would always stick it to us anytime they got the chance. They were part of the Hansa, that was the trading league in the Baltic, mm-hmm. Which again was organized mostly, as far as the Russians were concerned, to antagonize Russia. The Baltics were big fans of the Swedes and the Finns. And they would, again, get together, and as far as the Russians are concerned, these guys would get together for no other reason than to annoy us. And so the Russians haven't forgotten this. They haven't controlled the Baltic states for a long time, and now the Baltics are independent again, and as Austin is pointing out, they don't like it. So a lot of this stuff is just personal pique. There's no reason for a lot of this dislike. It's just sort of a national pastime. Hey, let's all get together, have a few drinks, and hate the Balts.
Now, weren't there a lot of Russians put into those Baltic states?
Yes,
too?
And that's another cause of, how should I put it, unhappiness. When they occupied the Baltic states in 1940 as part of the deal with Hitler, well, mainly after World War II, because the Germans moved right into the Baltic and the Baltic states and liberated them. But after World War II, they sent in a lot of Russian settlers, partially to replace all the people from the Baltic states who were sent off to the Gulag and never heard from again. But this was sort of a reward the Russians used for citizens who did good things. I mean, literally, they would give you papers to allow you to live in the Baltic states. And there you could lord it over the hated Balts. After the Cold War ended and the Baltic states were independent again, they basically gritted their teeth, and that was part of the deal, you know, to get their independence. They had to leave the local Russians alone. Some of them, one of them, I forget which one, anyway, some of them insisted that to become a citizen of the new Lithuania or Latvia or Estonia, you had to learn the local language. Actually, that wasn't too hard in Lithuania or Latvia, since they also speak a Slavic language, but Estonia speaks a language similar to Finnish, and that's very difficult. Central Asian language. That has caused a lot of bad blood, and basically it'll take a generation or more, because the younger, you know, Russophiles in the Baltic states are more than happy to adapt the Western outlook of the native Balts, and they will basically become, you know, for all intents and purposes, natives, no longer Russians. I mean, sure, they'll get razzed about it because, hey, your great-grandpa came from Russia, yeah. But basically, they'll have the same educational, economic, and political, you know, situation as the native-born, as it were. You know, well, everybody's native-born, but as the, you know, people who go back centuries.
Right.
So that's less of an issue than it could be. The Russians try and make something out of it, but basically, the people in the Baltic states, the Russians in the Baltic states, know they got a good deal.
Right.
So when the Russians, you know, yell and scream about, oh, you're oppressing the Russians, the Russians just would rather, you know, not hear this at all.
Right.
They're doing fine.
Right.
That doesn't apply as we move to certain other...
No. It's a unique situation in the Baltic states.
Yeah, that's right. One other thing about the Baltics is that you're also left with a historical anomaly, and that's the Kaliningrad Oblast.
Oh, yes.
That's actually part of Germany.
That's all part of Germany, not Russia.
That's right.
Not
and
the Baltic
states. That is that bit of... it's still part of Russia. That is on the Baltic. It's wedged in it's not contiguous with the.
Well, at least we don't have a Danzig corridor to worry about.
And it is heavily Russified. It used to be the German city, the Prussian city of.
The Hansa city, great trading port.
And it sits sits right there in the Mediterranean and is
the Baltic.
A curious leftover, is what it is.
And the Russians want to hang on to it because basically it's got great economic potential. It's sort of a free trading port. A lot of smuggling going on. And basically, a Russian with the right connections can make money in Kaliningrad, and many of them are.
It's a nice piece of terrain, but there it is.
Yeah, and it's still the headquarters for the Baltic Fleet.
Yeah, and it just sits there. It's this little wedge out in the. It's so interesting.
Basically, they just sit there collecting money.
Right.
And as long as that goes on, they're happy to just keep things as they are.
Well, let's move on to Belarus.
That's the last living part of the Soviet Union. Now, a lot of people say that as a joke, but it's not really a joke.
I know what Jim means by that, but okay, that's.
After the Cold War ended. A lot of the 14 new countries looked around and said, well, who's going to run the place now that we haven't got the center, what they called Moscow, to tell us what to do? Well, they quickly discovered that they had plenty of politicians, and these were the guys who came up through the Communist Party. And a lot of these guys were pretty resourceful. They said, hey, democracy? Sure, I can do that. And in many of these countries, as we'll discover in the next 10 minutes, did just that. They held elections, and basically they elected the only politicians available, which were the old communist bureaucrats. The problem in Belarus was they had some of the more corrupt communist bureaucrats, because, you know, that's what brought the Soviet Union down, the corruption within the Communist Party. And they basically have, more than anybody else, maintained the structures of the Soviet Union, the political, you know, governmental structures. So it's sort of like a political museum. It's literally a zoo, you might call it, the last living example of the Soviet Union. And it's a sad situation, and no one knows what's, because basically they have the police state working, you know, effectively, and they're being subsidized by Russia to keep them alive, because Russia considers it a buffer state, as it were, one of the few they have left.
I also think they look at Jim and I, when we war gamed the collapse of the Soviet Union before it collapsed, and we're thinking about, you can see this in I think it's the second edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War, we came up with something, and I called it the Rubik: Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and Kazakhstan. You put that together and you got a global power, because of the nature of resources, people, size, agriculture, as well as energy and the like. And the Belarus piece may seem the least important of the four, and it is, but it is part of the pieces. And Russia has would Belarus be Russia's closest ally? I mean, in Moscow's closest ally, well, in some ways it still functions as if it was part of.
Yeah, there have been attempts to reunite, with Russia, but they have been opposed in Belarus. I mean, the dictatorship that is working down there, they have to be careful, because people are unhappy with the situation. And what a wise dictator does is he doesn't apply any more pressure than he has to, because if things get out of hand, off with the king, off with the dictator's head. So basically, when they floated the idea of reuniting with Russia, they looked at the polls and said, well, let's leave that one alone for a while.
Right.
So we can only hope that there'll be another, soft revolution, like in the Ukraine, that will put a real democracy in charge. Before they the Russians and the apparatchiks, running Belarus, managed to finesse a reunification.
We're not predicting that that's going to happen, but understand that there are folks in Moscow and in some of these places that would like to see part of that combination return.
Right.
Yeah.
Now there are real tensions between Russia and the Ukraine. Correct.
That's like a Baltic state in the south. You have a lot of Russians moved in. Got to remember, Ukraine has been part of Russia for four centuries, but they never lost their sense of ethnic identity. I learned that firsthand back in the 60s when I was learning Russian in college, and I walked into a store down in the neighborhood in the Manhattan Lower East Side where a lot of Ukrainians, you know, immigrated after World War II. And actually, I think it was a liquor store, and I was getting a bottle of wine, and I said, Uminya, you know, whatever the brand was, and she looked at me with it. The woman looked at me with, you know, closed eyes and really stared at me and said, Virusky? You Russian? I said, yeah, Amerikansky, you better student. And, I mean, I don't know if she was going to pull a shotgun and let me have it. And I didn't know I had an act. I didn't know I'd lost my American accent all of a sudden. But, you know, it's vivid. And there were joyous celebrations after the Cold War ended and the Ukraine became independent once more. The trouble is, Eastern Ukraine is heavily populated by Russians. And as Austin points out, there are a lot of people in these former, you know, portions of the Soviet Empire who still feel nostalgia or lust, as the case may be, for a return, you know, to being part of the empire. But in Ukraine today, the majority of people, even a lot of the, you know, the ethnic Russians, like the idea of being an independent state, a democracy. I mean, as much as they miss the oil and nuclear weapons and all the other goodies you get by being part of Russia or the Soviet Union, life is a little sweeter, you know, by being away from all that as well.
Now, that was
Dan,
the
I'm
recent...
I'm looking at our time, and we hadn't even gotten to the south. Let's go.
Let's cover the stands real quick.
All right. Where do you want to start on the stands?
Well, let's cover them as a whole, because we haven't got much time. The five Central Asian republics, the Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, whatever, the stands as we call them, they were all conquered in the 19th century. These basically were the remnants of the Mongol Empire. This is the Great Plains of Central Asia. And they were basically a money-losing proposition from the word go. There's no there. I mean, why do you think the Mongols were out to conquer the world? Because there was nothing at home to keep them amused. These places, some of them have some oil, but basically they have a lot of Russian immigrants who are not popular. Most of them have left. You'll notice a lot of these Central Asian countries are run by guys who look, you know, East Asian, you know, the eyes, the face, the features, the facial features, right, but have a Russian, Slavic-sounding name. Well, that's part of, you know, 100 years or so of occupation, or several centuries, actually, of close economic and political, diplomatic relationships with the Tsarist empire. But basically, they have turned into Central Asian dictatorships. Not as bad as Belarus, and, of course, they're all Islamic. But they have managed to keep their Islamic radicals in check for the moment, have basically turned the place into the backwater there was when the Russians showed up in the 19th century.
We can't skip the Caucasus. I mean, the relationship between Russia and Georgia...
That's the ulcer of the empire.
Yeah, broke out into a war last August. Relationship between Russia and Armenia is very... Orthodox, well, it's the old connections there, but the Azerbaijanis certainly believe Russia favors Armenia, and Armenia would have made
well,
a
they
deal.
Do.
Now,
the Russians have always... Georgia and Armenia are the only Christian states there, and the Russians always consider them a buffer against the Turks.
That's why I said Orthodox there a minute ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Connection on that, but those are... hotspots, they're in flames, and of course the other issues that Russia has throughout the Caucasus, Chechnya ain't over,
no.
None of them are over, and that's part of the issue that Jim brought up early on about the decay of Russian forces. Understand that the Russians they still have some very capable elite forces, but it's just a tiny, tiny portion of their military, and this is why they are locked into so many small engagements. They're violent, and they aren't resolved because they've got these, I guess you'd call them paramilitary type forces that are engaged.
Yeah, the
Omar.
You know, one thing I think people have to understand about the Caucasus is like Somalia and Afghanistan. all those places have one thing in common. They are occupied by people who believe it's their God-given right to raid and plunder their neighbors. And that's how the Russians got involved in the Caucasus in the first place. You know, they when they came down on the steppes before they hit the, you know, the Caucasus Mountains, they were content to stay out of the mountains. But the people in the mountains were not content to stay out of Russia. And, you know, generation after generation of Dagestani, well, actually, there's about 40 different ethnic groups, the Chechens being among the largest in the South Caucasus, they would come down and plunder, they'd raid, they'd grab slaves and what have you. And so finally, the Tsar basically declared a crusade, for want of a better term, and it took them several generations, but they finally conquered the whole place, all the way down to Georgia and Armenia. And they've had nothing but trouble ever since, because the people in there are basically unconquerable. There's no other way to put it, just like the Somalis and the Afghans. You can cut deals, which the Russians have done, both Tsarist and communist. You can be, I mean, at one point in World War II, Stalin sent almost all of the Chechens to Central Asia because he thought they were going to cut a deal with the Germans, which I'm sure they were. And Khrushchev only let them back in the 1950s, which I'm sure the Russians, you know, regret. But the people in Central Asia were glad to see them go. So you have an intractable problem there, which will never, ever, well, not in our lifetime, probably several generations hence, you know, be solved.
And it's exacerbated by Islamist radicals who show up with more money than the locals, and they pull the same game they pulled in Somalia,
yeah,
and Afghanistan, and
yeah,
parts
exactly.
of Pakistan, and parts of the Philippines, and parts of Southeast Asia. I guess we move to China now. We've jumped over a lot of territory with the stands. The Russian-Chinese relationship is very complex because the Chinese still maintain that the Tsar took vast tracts of what is rightfully Chinese territory in Siberia. So that's
actually not Siberia. It's what the Russians call the Far East. Siberia is that area north of the stands, which the Russians never really had any dibs on. Westerners tend to call everything east of the Urals, you know, Siberia.
Yeah, that's what I was doing there.
And understood. But people should understand that the area in contention is north of China, and that's what the Russians call the Far East. It's a huge area. You know, it's the northern portion of eastern Eurasia.
Well,
but
you get into what are the classic spots along the Trans-Siberian Railroad. It is what we think of as the real, but it's
yeah.
of Siberia.
But the problem was, for a long time, there was no there. As far as the Chinese were concerned, the only thing up there was the northern barbarians. Again, the local version of the Somalis and the Chechens, who would come down and raid whenever they got a chance. And quite frankly, when the Russians first moved in there in the 18th century, initially the Chinese were quite happy. They said, hey, the Russians are a bunch of rough barbarians, and they'll keep the northern barbarians, you know, occupied. That's where the Huns came from up there. We're good with it. But the Russians, of course, moved south. They ended up in Manchuria. They fought a war with Russia 100 years ago. And as Austin points out, the Chinese would like to get it back. And as the Chinese are quite frank about, they feel they will get it back eventually because everybody has nukes, and they just as soon not fight a nuclear war over it.
Well, right. The thing is that there's an irony here. Is that Russians aren't known for really their economic or resource development, but they've done that, and they've exploited developed the resources in parts of the Far East and throughout the contended area, and the Chinese are interested in natural resources. So.
Yeah, but what the Chinese see themselves doing is moving more Chinese into Russia. Now, the Russians moan and groan about that, but they need the labor because the Russians were never able to get people to move to the Far East. It was basically the ass end of nowhere. Since they shut down the gulags, you know, the prison camps, after the Cold War ended, or actually even before the Cold War ended, they got no manpower, so they're importing North Koreans and Chinese are sneaking in, and it's getting, that's going to be a crisis in the next 5 or 10 years, because the Russians are not going to be able to look the other way. I mean, you already have areas along the border which are, nobody speaks Russian, it's all Chinese.
Right.
We skipped Mongolia, but the
Everybody skips Mongolia.
Yeah, but the Russians seem to get along with the Mongols, and the Mongols seem to still seem to. The Mongols are looking for a relationship with the United States.
Yeah, but again, there's no there there. That's why everybody ignores Mongolia.
And then we move to North Korea, which is a problem for all five of the. It's a North Korea, of course, a problem for China, Russia. South
well, that's
Korea,
one of the few places where you still have another Cold War museum area. You still have a Cold War era border.
Well,
the Russians guard that border, as do the North Koreans, very, very, very strictly.
Well, you've got another here. It's this on the other side of Russia. But I talked about the Kaliningrad Oblast. You've got between Russia and Japan another World War II.
The Kuril Islands.
The Kuril Islands, which it doesn't. The Japanese still look at part of the peninsular area as
Sakhalin.
That's right, as being part of. Rightfully part of Japan, but the Japanese have said they, bygones will be bygones. Let's co-develop resources in Siberia. Well, that's where the Japanese have looked at it, but there's still a contention over the Russian bases on some of the Kuril Islands that the Japanese have still believe are rightly Japanese islands.
Again, because of the nuclear weapons the Russians have and the Japanese don't,
it's not worth it.
It's not worth it. But it's basically an emotional thing for both sides. The Russians consider it, the things they took by blood, to World War II, and they're not about to give that up anytime soon. I mean, actually, the Japanese had a chance in the few years right after the Cold War ended, if they hadn't been so cheap, if they offered enough money, the Russians were willing to sell. And once that sale had been made, the Russians come back and yell and scream after that, but basically, a deal's a deal. But the Japanese dithered, and the opportunity, went away.
And that's a good place, I think, Dan, to point out that a deal is a deal in selling Alaska to the United States, because the maritime border between Russia and the United States, what is it, the Pribilof Islands? Is that the name of them, Jim?
Yeah.
That the split runs through on this seems to be... Well, if you call the Bering Strait quiet, it's all quiet.
Well, we've never fought a hot war with the Russians.
No, we haven't. No,
something to every our mutual benefit. Let's keep it that way.
the Reds think we did because of that regiment we had.
During the Civil War, right.
Yeah,
but never declared war.
No. So have we covered Russia, Dan?
I think so.
Yes, and we've run out of time.
And they have.
Out of time.
Just in time.
As we've proven by talking about everything, they've got a lot of things to think about.
Got a lot of issues, don't they?
Right.
Yeah.
And
so when they complain, you got to remember they got a lot to complain about.
Right.
And, well, but the thing is that when you see headlines where it says, I think it was Medvedev and then the Chinese, was it the Chinese president is saying that America's time was over, the U.S. Had lost it, and the future was not going to be run by the United States. Remember that headline of about 6 weeks ago?
Yeah.
I like this. Just take a look at Russia's issues and then do the same thing for China and think about that in terms of that kind of bombast from the leadership in Russia and China.
Yeah.
And
well,
I think our little tour at least shows... We just briefly talked about the internal issues when I brought that up, and I'll tell you what, those are huge.
Right.
And they may be larger than the border issues.
Right.
They are, I think.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, and we'll be talking to you next week.
Take care, guys.
Bye.